Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Heming way. Okay, apparently I've got the hiccups all of a sudden. Sorry if that sounded gross. It probably did. Excuse me one second while I open up the various windows that I need to do this podcast. Why is Zulu spoiling them with money and snacks? And what did you think of the tin can caper? Those are the questions that I asked you about. Chapter 9, Part 2. I Am Norwegian said, this chapter was pretty entertaining. Cummings has stayed on the same characters for long enough to where we get an idea of who they are. That at least makes the snapshots of prison life easier to get immersed in. The tin can caper was exciting. I was sure the woman would end up being punished, but somehow she got away. I like the Zulu character. He is mysterious, and I have no idea how to picture him except as some lanky ghost-like thing that floats around. It did take me some time to realize that he was Polish and not South African, embarrassingly enough. I listened to some of yesterday's reading, and Anders' rant on adjectives reminded me of this. When you catch an adjective, kill it. No, I don't mean utterly, but kill most of them. Then the rest will be valuable. They weaken when they are close together. They give strength when they are far apart. Now, that's a nice little quote. I wonder whose that quote is. Hopefully tomorrow's chapter won't make me want to merge with the realm of the unconscious. that's funny. Good one. I Am Norwegian. Tech Rivik said, is that Twain or Hemingway? I'm reasonably sure it's not both, although quotes get attributed wrongly all the time, so I'm not being facetious. I Am Norwegian said, I think it's Twain. There's a lot of similar quotes about adjectives, though. I remember coming across a selection of them in... I'm 90% sure Hemingway had his own quote there, though this was the first one to pop up when I tried to Google my way to the list. It's a good quote. It sums up a whole... There's a whole chapter in Stephen King's On Writing which talks about not just adjectives, but descriptive language and unnecessary words. Cutting out unnecessary words and training yourself to spot unnecessary words in your sentences and paragraphs in all different ways, like adjectives, repetitive adjectives, tautological sentences, things that can be inferred without needing to be explicitly said. And he kind of takes you through it. And then once you get that in your head and you go back and edit some of your own writing, you realize that you can trim it down by 20, 30% and not lose any meaning, actually lose any of the meaning that was in there. It's pretty incredible. Sorry, just logging in to my account here because for some reason it just booted me out. All right, that's better. Cool. Anyway, that's all the conversation there was actually about today's one, but that's a cool little quote from Twain. Thank you very much for sharing that, Norwegian. And now we're going to read the first half of chapter 10 of The Enormous Room. I still got the hiccups, which is called Surplice. Let us ascend to the third delectable mountain, which is called Surplice. Wait, first I just need to count how long this chapter is. 3, 6, 9, 12, 13. Okay, so I need to read about 6 pages-ish. It's a fairly short chapter, I'm still just going to do a halfie. Let us ascend the third delectable mountain, which is called Surplice. I will admit in the beginning that I never knew Surplice. This for the simple reason that I am unwilling to know, except as a last resort. And it is by contrast with Harry, the Hollander, whom I knew, and Judas, whom I knew, that I shall be able to give you, perhaps, a little of Surplice, whom I did not know. For that matter, I think Monsieur Auguste was the only person who might possibly have known him, and I doubt whether Monsieur Auguste was capable of descending to such depths in the case of so fine a person as Surplice. I just got really curious. Sorry. Ah, there it is. Such a fine a person as Surplice. This will speak volumes about my mindset right now. Just mid-reading that, I got really curious of, do I have a copy of Anna Karenina in my bookcase? I'm pretty sure I do somewhere. And I started browsing my bookcase looking for Anna Karenina. Shows you how focused I am on this book. Take a sheer animal of a man. Take the incredible Hollander, the with cobalt blue breeches, shock of orange hair pasted over forehead, pink long face, 26 years old, had been in all the countries of all the world. Australia girl, fine girl, Japanese girl, cleanest girl of the world, Spanish girl, all right, English girl, no good, no face. Everywhere these things, Norway, sailors, German girl, Swedish matches, Holland candles. Had been to Philadelphia, worked on a yacht for a millionaire, knew and had worked in the crap factories, was on two boats, torpedoed, and one, which struck a mine, went inside of shore through the looking glass. Holland, almost no soldier, India, the Dutch Indies, nice place, always warm. There, I was in cavalry. If you kill a man or steal 100 franc or anything, in prison, 24 hours, every week, black girl, sleep with you because the government want white children. Black girl, fine girl, always doing something. Your fingernails are clean. Your fingernails all clean. Your ears all make wind because it's hot. No one can beat German people. If Kaiser tell man to kill his father and mother, he do it quick. The tall, strong, coarse, vital youth who remarked, I sleep with black girl who smoke a pipe in the night. Take this animal. You hear him. You are afraid of him. You smell and you see him and you know him, but you do not touch him. Or a man who makes us thank God for animals, Judas, as we call him, who keeps his moustaches in press during the night by means of a kind of transparent frame which is held in place by a band over his head. Who grows the nails of his two little fingers with infinite care, has two girls with both of whom he flirts carefully and wisely, without ever once getting into trouble, talks in French, converses in Belgian, can speak 8 languages, and is therefore always useful to Monsieur le Surveillant. Judas, with his shining horrible forehead pecked with little indentures, with his Reynard full face, Judas, with his pale, almost putrescent, fatty body in the douche, Judas, with whom I talked one night about Russia, he wearing my pelisse, the frightful and impeccable Judas, take this man. You see him? You smell the hot, stale odour of Judas's body. You are not afraid of him. In fact, you hate him. You hear him and you know him, but you do not touch him. And now take Surplice, whom I see and hear and smell and touch and even taste, and whom I do not know. Take him in dawn's soft squareness, gently stooping to pick chewed cigarette ends from the spitty floor. Hear him all night, retchings which light into the dark. See him all day and all days, collecting his soaked ends and stuffing them gently into his round pipe. When he can find none, he smokes tranquilly, little splinters of wood. Watch him scratching his back, exactly like a bear, on the wall, or in the core, speaking to no one, sunning his soul. He is, we think, Polish. Monsieur Auguste is very kind to him. Monsieur Auguste can understand a few words of his language and thinks they mean to be Polish. That they are trying hard to be and never can be Polish. Everyone else roars at him. Judas refers to him before his face as a dirty pig. Monsieur Peters cries angrily, Il ne fuit pas creature par terre. Eliciting a humble, not to say abject, apology. The Belgians spit on him, the Hollanders chaff him, and bulldoze him now and then, crying syphilis, at which he corrects them with offended majesty, pass syphilis surplus, causing shouts of laughter from everyone. Of nobody can say, my friend, of no one has he ever, or will ever, he say, my enemy. When there is labour to do, he works like a dog. The day we had Notillage de Chamber, for instance, and Surplice and the Hat did most of the work, and B and I were caught by the planton, trying to stroll out into the corps. Every morning he takes the pail of solid excrement down, without anyone suggesting that he take it, takes it as if it were his, empties it in the sewer just beyond the corps de femme, or pause a little, just a little, very delicately on the garden where Monsieur le Directeur is growing a flower for his daughter. He has, in fact, an unobstreperous affinity for excrement. He lives in it. He is shaggy and spotted and blotched with it. He sleeps in it. He puts it in his pipe and says it's delicious. And he is intensely religious with a terrible and exceedingly beautiful and absurd intensity. Every Friday he will be found sitting on a little kind of stool by these palais, reading his prayer book upside down, turning his enormous delicacy to the thin, difficult leaves, smiling to himself as he sees and does not read. Surplice is actually religious, and so are Garibaldi and I think the woodchuck, a little dark, sad man who spits blood with regularity. By which I mean they go to La Messe for La Messe, whereas everyone else goes pour vivre la femme. And I don't know for certain why the woodchuck goes, but I think it's because he feels entirely sure he will die. And Garibaldi is afraid, immensely afraid, and Surplice goes in order to be surprised, surprised by the amazing gentleness and delicacy of God, who put him, Surplice, upon his knees in La Ferté Macher, knowing that Surplice would appreciate his so doing. He is utterly ignorant. He thinks America is out a particular window on your left as you enter the enormous room. He cannot understand the submarine. He does now know that there is a war. On being informed upon these subjects, he is utterly surprised, unutterably surprised. He is inexpressibly astonished. He derives huge pleasure from this astonishment. His filthy, rather proudly noble face radiates the pleasure he receives upon being informed that people are killing people for nobody knows what reason, that boats go underwater and fire 6-foot-long bullets at ships, that America is not really outside the window close to which we are talking, that America is in fact over the sea. The sea is that water, c'est de l'eau, monsieur, a great quantity of water, enormous amounts of water. Water and then water, water and water and water and water and water. Ah, you cannot see the other side of this water, monsieur. Wonderful, monsieur, he meditates it, smiling quietly. It's wonder. How wonderful it is, no other side, and yet the sea in which fish swim, wonderful. He is utterly curious, he is a little hungry. We have bought cheese, and with the Toulouse money. Surplice comes up, bows timidly and ingratiatingly with the demeanour of a million times, whipped but a somewhat proud dog. He smiles, he says nothing, being terribly embarrassed. To help his embarrassment, we do not see him. That makes things better. Fromage, monsieur? Oui, c'est du fromage. Ah ha ha ha. His astonishment is supreme. C'est du fromage. He ponders this after a little. Monsieur, c'est bon, monsieur? Asking the question as if his very life depended on the answer. Yes, it is good, we tell him reassuringly. Ah ha 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 ha. He is once more superlatively happy. It is good, le fromage. Could anything be more superbly amazing? After perhaps a minute, monsieur, monsieur, c'est sûr le fromage. Very, we tell him truthfully. He smiles, blissfully astonished. Then with extreme delicacy and the utmost timidity conceivable, monsieur, combien cacutim, monsieur. We tell him. He totters with astonishment and happiness. Only now, as if we had just conceived the idea, we say carelessly, en voulez-vous? He straightens, thrilled from the top of his rather beautiful, filthy head to the soleless slippers with which he promenades in the rain and frost. Merci, monsieur. We cut him a piece. He takes it quiveringly, holds it a second, as a king might hold and contemplate the best and biggest jewel of his realm, turns with profuse thanks to us, and disappears. He is perhaps most curious of this pleasantly sounding thing, which everyone around him, everyone who curses and spits upon and bullies him, desires with a terrible desire, liberté. Whenever anyone departs, Surplice is in an ecstasy of quiet excitement. The lucky man may be Fritz, for whom Bathhouse John is taking up a collection, as if he, Fritz, were a Hollander and not a Dane. For whom Bathhouse John is striding hither and thither, shaking a hat into which we drop coins for Fritz, Bathhouse John, chipmunked-cheeked, who talks Belgian, French, English, and Dutch in his dreams, who has been 2 years in La Ferté, and they say he declined to leave once when given the chance, who cries Bagneur de femme moi, and every night hoists himself into his wooden bunk, crying good night, whose favourite joke is Une section pour la femme, which he shouts occasionally in the core as he lifts his paper-soled slippers and stamps in the freezing mud, chuckling and blowing his nose on the Union Jack. And now Fritz, beaming with joy, shakes hands and thanks us all and says to me, goodbye, Johnny, and waves and is gone forever. Behind me, I hear a timid voice, Monsieur Liberty. And I say yes, feeling that yes in my belly and in my head at the same instant. And Serpice stands beside me, quietly marvelling, extremely happy, uncaring that Le Parti did not think to say goodbye to him. Or it may be Harry and Pompom, who are running to and fro, shaking hands with everybody in the wildest state of excitement. And I hear a voice behind me, Liberté, Monsieur Liberté. And I say no. Presigne, feeling weirdly depressed, and Serpice is standing to my left, contemplating the departure of the incorrigibles with interested disappointment. Surplice, of whom no man takes any notice when that man leaves, be it for hell and paradise. And once a week, the maitre d'hôtel chamber throws soap on the mattresses, and I hear a voice, Monsieur voulez passe, and Surplice is asking that we give him our soap to wash with. Sometimes when he has made quilques sous by washing for others, he stalks quietly to the butcher's chair, everyone else who wants a shave having been served, and receives with shut eyes and a patient expression the blade of the butcher's dullest razor. For the butcher is not a man to waste a good razor on Surplice. He, the butcher, as we call him, the successor of the frog, who one day somehow managed to disappear like his predecessor, the barber, being a thug and a regular fond of telling us pleasantly about German towns and prisons, prisons where men were not allowed to smoke, clean prisons where there is daily medical inspections, where anyone who thinks he has a grievance of any sort has the right of immediate and direct appeal. He, the butcher, being perhaps happiest when he can spend an evening knowing us little parlour tricks fit for children of 4 or 3 years old, quite at his best when he remarks, sickness doesn't exist in France, meaning that one is either well or dead, or, if they, the French, get an inventor, they put him in prison. I think we'll end it there. I think we'll end it there for today. It's about halfway. Looks like a good spot to finish. All right. Have your say about this chapter on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.